accession number 20456, reel 10.
Brigadier Wilson, reel 10. You were saying that Wavell had the same bodyguards he would have had 15 years earlier when he was commanding the brigade.
Guard of Honour. Well, at the end of this parade, which was in the Naga Hills after Kama, it was suggested that maybe he'd like to say something to the assembled gathering. And Wavell was never a guy for saying anything to anyone. He was somewhere. And with somewhat bad grace, after all, this was his own division, his own brigade, everything, he said, I don't think they'd be interested, would they? And Cam Nicholson said, yes, please, sir, they would appreciate it. And he made the most astonishing speech. I've never forgotten it. It wasn't really a speech. He sort of looked at us out of his one eye, and he said, I expect you think that you, I'm going to tell you how well you've done. But he said, no, he said, you've done what I was expecting, what you've been trained to do. And he said, that's what I was expecting in my division. And he said, I'm going to talk about something quite different. He said, the war is won. Now, this was September 1944. And he said, I can't tell you when it will end, but he said, the Germans and the Japanese cannot now win. And he said, in due course, I don't know when this is going to be, you'll all be split up and go home. And you're going to be in for a great disappointment. Because when you get back there, you'll find a lot of things have changed. You'll probably think have changed for the worse. And you'll wonder what you've been fighting for. And he said, but I can tell you that it will take all the discipline and the training that you've picked up in the army to get over there. And you'll find, in fact, that it's all been worthwhile. And he said, that isn't anything very sort of marvelous to look forward to, is it? But he said, it's going to be the truth. Well, they all came off their parades, sucking their teeth and saying, what? No one's talked to us quite like that before. We never thought about it like that. And of course they hadn't. And how right he was.
Showed considerable foresight.
Oh, yes. He's a wonderful guy. I don't think that they'd have taken it from anyone else. Very interesting.
What did you do then after the amphibious operation was cancelled? I think you said...
Well, we went back...
Went back to battle school.
Retrained. No. Sixth Brigade. We then had got a bit more information.
Yes.
About Japanese tactics, and so we started training in very close quarters with tanks in the jungle. For the first time, for example, the tank telephone, you know what I mean by that, the back of the tank, you could... And so you had infantry sections with each tank, talking directly to the tank and saying, you know, slightly left over there, you know. That sort of thing, it was a... we really uprated our training quite a bit.
Was this back at Ahmednagar again?
No, this is Belgorm. This is
Belgorm,
yeah.
What sort of tanks did you have?
Grant Lees and Shermans.
Which of those did you prefer?
Oh, Sherman, if you can get it. You see, the other tank had a sponson-mounted gun.
Yes.
And not so manoeuvrable to, you know, it couldn't depress it quite as much as the Sherman. It had got all round traverse.
How did you actually plan to use tanks with infantry in the jungle? It seemed rather...
Well, purely for bunker busting in those days. I mean, the idea that we were going to break through and have that the mad dash that they did right at the end of the war never really had sort of formed part of it, because no one quite imagined what was going to happen. Not then.
So would it be right then to say that the tanks would be operating in very small numbers, possibly as singletons?
Very small numbers, yes. Yes.
Presumably that would have required a considerable mental adjustment by the tank regiments, because they were accustomed to the idea of working together, weren't they?
Well, in large bodies. Yes. Well, except that by then, after the Arakan, it was getting obvious that in that stage of the war there was going to be no sort of great mass tank attacks, and squadrons and things, and it was going to be a sort of one man, one tank battle, sort of. I mean, for example, that incredible business where the 3rd Carbineers got up that mountain called Nam Shi Gan, which was no one ever thought of a tank getting up a thing like that.
Did you find that all the tank units you had the same sort of outlook and temperament?
Well, we only worked with one tank unit at Covey. Well, no, we had 7th Cavalry as well. We had 149 RAC, XKYLI. They were very, very good. There we had no complaints regarding their outlook. They were marvellous.
It's often said that tanks are really at a very great disadvantage operating in any sort of close country, whether it's an urban area or a heavily forested area.
True.
And are reluctant to get themselves into such country.
They may have been reluctant. They didn't have any choice.
Mm. Were there any special arrangements you could make to protect them from?
Yes, at night risks? You had to take them. You had to make quite certain you got them into some sort of harbour at night. You protected them. Because they had to rest, you see. There was one case at Kohima where one tank for 3 days sat on FSD Ridge in amongst a platoon of Welsh fusiliers, quite isolated. And by night we were carrying up ammunition and petrol for it with porters. You know, we could just about get after it. And that tank crew for 4 days sat in that tank. They could get out, so it was like fascinating.
What about the infantry adjusting to the idea of working with tanks? Because there are certain risks of getting squashed, aren't there, if you're operating in close proximity with an armoured vehicle.
No problems, none whatsoever.
Who actually worked out the tactics of employing tanks and infantry at such close quarters?
I don't know. It just happened. I think, again, it started with a debacle in the Arakan in the beginning of 43. We worked it out for ourselves.
And was it worked out by trial and error and experiments in the
battle? Well, I think it was,
story?
yes.
What was the most useful part of the tank's armament in jungle fighting?
Oh, well, the main gun, as far as bunker busting was concerned, you see. The turret gun was not heavy enough to it'll deal with a small bunker, it'll deal with Japanese troops in the open, but for the big bunker, you had to use a 75.
Main armament.
Yeah. Mm.
When did you get your orders to go up to Assam, to the Kohima area?
Okay, March 19. Beginning of March 1944.
How much warning did you have of your your move?
Very little. You were down in Belgorm, you know, and suddenly the signal arrived. Pack up. Back to Aminaga. And that took us, I suppose, 2 days. And when we got to Aminaga, we were then given our orders as to get to Kohima. Well, of course, it's a long way. And you had three main ways of getting there. One was the train, boat train. The other was a combination of that and a long road convoy, and the other was entirely by road. And the first people to arrive, obviously, were the train parties. But they only had sufficient flats to put X number of guns and gun towers and things on. So most of your transport had to go by road and joined you later.
Did you get involved in planning this move?
Yes.
What was your role in doing that? How were you involved?
Well, it was rather like combined operations. I mean, first of all, we were given a timetable in the order in which brigades would arrive. And we were then given the allocation of trains and flats with a timetable of when they were to be loaded, were to leave. And we had to work out, because the first people who wanted there were the infantry and the guns, and of course some engineers. But you couldn't take the whole lot at once. So the infantry actually had the first priority.
Who issued you with those outline orders and allocations? Was this a corps staff or army staff?
You know, I got my orders direct from division, you see.
Yes. Came down through division, presumably.
Through division. Mm. So I do not know. Mm. Obviously, Delhi, I'm talking about GHQ, Delhi and the Indian Railways, obviously produced the transportation. It was up to us to make the best use of it we could, which was very like, as I say, combined operations in reverse. Instead of ships, you had trains.
It's a case of allocating units to trains rather than to landing.
That's exactly. And again, with the units, you had to move a certain amount of signals. And it was a choice. You had a choice of just how much you could take and when you wanted it to arrive.
Who decided on that? Was that you, or was it the brigade commander who decided who should go and in what order?
Basically the brigade commander. But you see, the trouble was that we didn't really know what was happening. After all, 1,500 miles away, what were we going to be required to do when we got there?
You had no background briefing?
Well, we had briefing, yes, that they'd the Japanese were tearing out into the Imphal plain, and our job originally was to make quite certain that the big depot at Dimapur was secure, and the railway line, because the railway line was the heart of the American supply to their airfield, Dinjan, flying over the hump to China. And the Americans took great store by that, because they obviously, the more Chinese they could keep going, the more Japanese they could absorb.
And the less pressure they would suffer in the Pacific.
Elsewhere, yeah. Yeah, and Burma. Yeah. And so when we got there to Kohima, there was a series of order, counter, disorder, because Kohima itself was not an operational base. It was a base, yes, but with no fighting troops in it. And you had the whole business of units appearing at Kohima, then ordered on. The West Kents who appeared at Kohima, 161 Brigade, then ordered back. We, who were ordered to protect the railway, were suddenly said, for God's sake, stop protecting the railway, get up to Kohima. The start of that battle was a very strange one, to say the least.
Was this a natural consequence of the fact the Japanese had achieved a certain degree of strategic surprise in their...
Well, yes, you see, they did not expect... They thought, rightly so, that all the Japanese would produce against Kohima was one regiment. Little did they realize they'd get a division there. And all because we had opened this secondary road going through Sangshak, the jeep track, which was exactly what the Japanese required.
So they turned our arrangements back upon us?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Yeah. Made it a lot easier for them. Mind you, Nishida had been there a year before. He was a regular officer of Japanese Intelligence Corps, a very, very remarkable guy, with some Naga and Cookie helpers, and had done the reconnaissance of the route to Kohima, and so they were able to take with them a certain amount of prefabricated bridging kit.
But this had been specially designed for the purpose.
Yes, very much so.
Not standard kit.
No, this was specially designed stuff for the purpose to get them across the Cookie Hills, which was, I mean, whatever you can say about their administrative moves afterwards, the advance of 31 Div over that country was quite remarkable. And no one had foreseen it.
What was your own activity then? I think you said that you were in the 6th Brigade Advance Party for the move forward.
Well, yes. Well, A, trying to sort of make some order of the arrival of the 6th Brigade parties.
At Dimapur.
B, 5th Brigade were sent up towards Kohima, and we had to take over some of the railway line protection from them, so that had to be organized at the same time as other bits and pieces were coming in. So life was pretty busy. I had no idea at the time of the real extremities that Kohima garrison were going through. We didn't know then quite who we were up against.
Did anybody know at that stage who you were up against?
Oh, yes. Certainly they knew at Kohima. They knew, you see, the people that have never got the real credit for it were the Indian Parachute Brigade at the Battle of Sangshak. If they had not been there and had knocked 58 regiment pieces, I don't quite know what might have happened.
Well, if the Japanese had captured Kohima, what would have been the immediate consequences?
Well, I mean, it would have been very difficult to retake. I don't think that if the Japanese had captured Dimapur, then we would have been in bad trouble.
Dimapur was the next stop along the line.
Well, Dimapur was the main supply base for the whole of Imphal. It was considerable railway sidings, you know, and considerable, you know, what you would imagine a main supply base to be.
How did you get up there yourself with the Brigade Advance Party?
Oh, I went by train with the Brigadier.
Who else was in the Advance Party? The Brigadier, yourself?
Myself, Paddy Burke, Chief Signals Officer, two of our liaison officers, DAQMG, enough to establish a proper brigade headquarters. Jack Theobald's and the rear brigade headquarters followed two trains later.
And what was the work of the advance party to be? You say set up a brigade headquarters, and then what would that do once it was up and working?
Well, I mean, we had to get a sort of assemble the brigade, as it were, you know.
In Dimapur.
yes. Our headquarters, we first went to Dimapur, then there was a place called Nishugard, about 10 miles north of Dimapur, which was a pass.
I think you said that initially you thought that you were going to be guarding the railway.
Yes, we did.
Would that have been the railway from Dimapur
down northwards,
to...
northwards, well, in both directions.
In both directions.
But the Japanese actually had come in north of Dimapur.
Yes.
And so basically the... it was the northern bit that was worrying people. Yeah.
How were you supposed to protect the railway? Was it to be protected by fixed posts or by patrols or a combination
the
of
the railway
two?
Ran through a valley, and the hills came quite down close to the railway, and there were a lot of Naga villages in the hills, and so one sent garrisons into these villages. We didn't actually come in contact with the Japs in that job. Fire Brigade did.
So how long a stretch of railway were you actually guarding with the brigade when you were deployed in that role?
I suppose about 30-odd miles.
So one brigade could cover 30-odd miles of
railway?
Well,
you couldn't cover it, but at least you could picket it, you know.
Right? Yes.
And the point about it was there were no Japanese further north of that. We knew that.
Yes. What sort of scale of deployment would you make on those hills in the villages?
You had company groups.
Company groups. What would be in a company group?
Well, we had whole company, an FOO, they had some mortars, machine guns. Enough to defer Japanese from, you know, coming down onto the railway.
What sort of terrain?
Very mountainous. The hills started where the railway left off, as it were. I mean, if we were on the railway here, your hills started climbing into the far woods. I mean, it wasn't quite nice, sort of flat, paddy stuff.
So. You got company groups. Were they dug in and wired in?
No, they were. We didn't have much. Wired didn't. It's very interesting. The whole thing, if you read about it, is shortage of wire.
Oh.
I don't. See, didn't have any wired Kohima. It made a lot of difference. They'd have wired Kohima. No, they were based on our villages, sending out patrols down the tracks.
What sort of scale of patrol would you be sending out? Would it be platoon scale, section scale?
No, they were section scale, basically. Yeah.
Were these essentially security and recce patrols?
Well, basically it was recce patrols sufficiently strong to engage any Japanese that might or might not have come down that particular way.
And how far would they go beyond the village?
Oh, probably 5-10 miles.
Could you describe this really as being basically a screening operation rather than a defending operation?
You've got it. Screening. Yeah. We missed contact with Japanese. We had no idea how many of them there were, where they were coming. They might have gone. They might have. If they'd covered us in force, we would have been in trouble.
What sort of relations did you have with the Nagas?
Marvellous. You have this strange business between the Nagas and the Kukis. Some of the Kukis were all right,
yes.
But basically the Nagas were totally loyal. Mm. The Kukis were a bit anti-British in some ways. Some of them.
Had they been anti-British before the war?
Oh, Lord, yes.
Oh.
So the Nagas. I mean, frightful murders and things that had been done in the late 1800s, early 1900s there. The big idea was to cut your enemy's head off and hang it in your house, because that gave you extra power, you know.
Do you know why it is that Nargis had become completely loyal in the face of
well,
the
Japanese I think threat? Well, they were nearer India than the Kukis, and I think they were better administered by the district officers. I don't know why, but they were.
Could it be the Kuki? I mean, were the Kukis traditionally on good terms with the Nagas? Or
no, they weren't. They were on good terms with the Nagas. They chopped each other's heads off with great regularity.
Could it be that the reason for the Kukis giving some support to the Japanese was to spite the Nagas as part of a feud?
I think the Kukis were nearer the Japanese, and the Japanese sort of made rather more friends with them. I don't know.
What sort of things did the Nagas do to assist you then, if they were actively loyal?
Oh, well, they acted as porters. They acted as scouts. They produced an intelligence network for us and their own district officers. They sabotaged sort of Japanese supply lines. I don't quite know how you could really describe them. They were an irregular force, very anti-Japanese, very pro-us.
You're saying that you really had a complete deficiency of information on which to base plans. How then did you decide where to put your picketing companies? Was it simply
you look at a map and you see where the roads are going and you think, well, okay, we'll have to block this particular track. They weren't roads, they were tracks, they were hill tracks.
So it's an analysis of the terrain that
determines. And
who actually did that? Was it the brigade commander who looked at the map and said, we need to cover these particular areas?
No, I think you've got a very odd mix-up of command. You see, there was a major general at Dimapur called Rankin, but he wasn't a fully operational major general. He was...
base waller, was he?
He was 202 sub-area.
Yes.
And Richard Chapp was suddenly faced with sort of trying to give... operational decisions for no operational troops. Then 161 Brigade appeared under Daddy Warren, and then we appeared. And then eventually 33 Corps under Monty Stopford took over the whole thing. Once 33 Corps got itself organized, then life became a lot different.
Was it improved?
What?
Was that change an improvement?
Oh, yes, I mean... Well, you had what you might call a proper operational chain of command, which meant that information was beginning to sort of get up and down the line a bit. And it was no fault of 202 area. They didn't have any, they didn't have the signals, they didn't have the staff to do it.
Well, presumably their main concerns have been logistic and administrative.
Their main concern was looking after Dimapur base, that was all.
Where did you have brigade headquarters? Was that in Dimapur itself?
To start with, yes. And then we moved up. I have 1st of April, 5 Brigade beginning to arrive.
Yes.